Hello and welcome to Inside Intercom. I'm Liam Geraghty. Over the past few months, we have all witnessed the breathtaking acceleration of AI as it has become a daily part of our lives. The scale of the disruption that AI promises to bring has raised widespread questions and concerns. So on today's show, Intercom's Senior Director of Machine Learning, Fergal Reid, sits down to chat with VP of Product Design, Emma Connolly, for a very frank and honest conversation about the world of AI. Here's Emmett.
So, Fergal, we've had lots of casual chats over beers and coffees and so on, and we said that it might be interesting to try and sit down and have one and record it, mostly because, you know, we've observed, as we have worked with directly with large language models and so on, largely over the last 6 months, for most of us, for me at least personally, we've been grappling with product questions that are directly applicable to what we're trying to get done at work today. But there is, of course, a large conversation in the wider world about what AI means and the future of AI, but not a lot in, let's say, the product building community. And we just thought we would try and like sit down and touch on some of the questions around what is this new material that we're dealing with? What are some of the potential impacts of technology? What are the things that we should be paying attention to that we're not, maybe? And so, yeah, maybe we'll just kick off. First of all, do you have any overarching reflections on the last 6 months, which is for not for you probably, but for most of us, the period of time that we've really started to properly like engage with AI as a topic?
I think, let's see how this goes. It's going to be a bit of an experiment. Look, I think it's fair to say that even people who've worked in machine learning or worked in AI have been caught by surprise by how fast things got better. And I think that's true of even a lot of people who are like experts in the field or people, you know, who've worked with neural networks and stuff for a long time. It's been surprising that like when, you know, OpenAI have pushed the scale a lot recently and others, that the models got as intelligent as they did. So I think that like that's been deeply surprising for a lot of people and shocking. And so I think, I think that's generally true. I don't think anyone isn't surprised by that.
Do you think some AI folks are a bit concerned that they might be working on the Manhattan Project now of our generation? I mean, a while ago you were working to autocomplete text or whatever it was, and suddenly this has become a very fraught, debated, much discussed like topic. How does it feel for AI people working on AI to be at the center of that?
I guess to like set out my perspective, right? We're not here. We're not like training large language models. Instead, we're using them. We're consumers of them. We've been early consumers of them. We've had early access to GPT-4, but like we're not training them ourselves. But on the other hand, you know, I have a team of people here who are like experts on AI. A lot of us have been in AI for like, I guess, decades at this point. Like when I was in college, I was really interested in advanced AI. I was reading books on like the philosophy of AI and, you know, people debating whether it could ever do this or that. And then now we have like real systems in the world that suddenly make a lot of those debates less relevant. Suddenly it's like, oh, here's a system that can actually do this thing nobody said it could ever do. And so I think it's a very interesting point in time from that. I don't know who has the best view on this. You know, I guess a counterpoint is that like if you're training large language models, like there's an extent to which it is an engineering task, right? You go and you do all your training, and then afterwards you get this model and the model comes out and it's like really, really intelligent. You didn't like individually code that intelligence. Like it's still machine learning. So there's an extent to which I think everybody is surprised by this. Like it's not like people incrementally build up capability one line of code at a time. Instead, it's like people finish a big training run and, you know, they see it as it goes. They see it improve as it goes, but is an extent to which no one's sure what's going to happen at the end of a big training run.
But do we have any analogies? I kind of like somewhat jokingly alluded to the Manhattan Project, but I guess it's a pretty good analogy perhaps to some of the stuff that we're dealing with.
In what way? Like, because it's dangerous?
Well, we've discovered a way to manipulate something, in this case, information. It feels more like a discovery than an invention in a sense, right? Like very broadly applicable. We're not sure what the unintended consequences of its use are. And of course, it could be put to use by bad actors for malicious purposes as much as good actors for positive purposes, right?
I think OpenAI actually released a position statement around like, you know, this tech and calling for kind of like oversight of AI tech. And they drew parallels to nuclear tech and also to like biotech, synthetic biology or something like that. But basically, I do think that's fair. I think like it's potentially in that category of like scary technology where humans don't know what they're messing with kind of thing, right? In the finest traditions of science fiction. Yeah, so I buy the idea that this could all go wrong, that like training large language models is something people, it feels like people start need to be careful about, yeah.
I'd love to talk a little bit about what you feel like we have actually discovered. And I keep saying discovered because it almost feels like a discovery and the way we're talking about it, like, well, we've got this thing and we're not sure how to, we better be careful how we handle it and so on, feels like a thing we've discovered. Is that how you think about it? Like, I obviously, you know, we know on a technical level how these models are trained, but there's the black box situation of, but we don't really understand exactly how they produce the somewhat non-deterministic results that they're giving us.
I think that is the right way to think about it. It's a system. You start off the system and you set up like a training objective first, and then you go and you run on that scale and you sort of see what happens. And over time you get better and better at like, you know, understanding what's likely to happen. But you're not sure. You're sort of like testing it and seeing. And so I think like good analogies here are like, hey, imagine you have, you know, a biological system and you go and you set it out to grow for a while and then you come back and you see what it does, right? Yeah. It's closer to that. This sort of like machine learning at scale, training large models at scale, you know, some of which we do here, although not as large, you know, is in that area, right? It's like you got to test it in this black box way. You got to check its behavior. You don't know what you're going to get.
So we do have a world where we have biological systems that go out into the world and learn stuff, and often by, you know, pattern matching and so on. And I guess this then is where the obvious question of like, so is this intelligent comes from? And this is a big question that's preoccupied a lot of conversation. I think largely because people are kind of like auto-completing to, because if it is intelligent, that means we're on the path to AGI. That AGI could be malign. And we could be in for big trouble. And so let's have the conversation right now, which seems like it's a very worthwhile thing to, you know, wave the flag about, but also the thing that's driving like a lot of anxiety around the technology.
Yeah, I think a degree of caution or anxiety is fair here, right? Like, let's assume that these things are getting intelligent. We can come back to that, right? Like, intelligence is really scary. Intelligence is really dangerous, right? Like, humans arguably are like the most dangerous. We have a big impact on the earth, a big impact on the ecosystem. It's not because we're like, you know, stronger, not the strongest animal or the fastest animal. A human can kill a lion because the human's more intelligent than a lion. Like, more intelligent organisms are in a sense more dangerous, or are often more dangerous. And so the idea that we could end up creating something here that's more intelligent than us, like, could be really dangerous. We've no experience with that. And so, you know, I think some degree of caution is totally warranted there.
I think we need to get a bit better at thinking about different types of intelligence. So when we say that, I think we autocomplete to like very human-esque intelligence. And if a human was that more intelligent than the rest of us, then, you know, what are the malign things that they could do?
I mean, not necessarily. Like, I'm not sure there has to be human-shaped intelligence to be dangerous.
To be, for sure. Like, a lion has some intelligence and is dangerous coupled with its capabilities, right? But this has no embodiment, right? I mean, it has access to systems, like computer systems, I guess, that could be very damaging as well.
Yeah.
But like, is malignancy a human trait, I guess? And why do we immediately project that potential for that onto the system?
I think the thing a lot of people are saying is it doesn't need to be malignant. It doesn't need to be like intentionally bad. It doesn't need to be much intention at all. All you need is to create something that, you know, is trying to optimize some objective that brings it into conflict with good things humans want, right? Yeah. And so there's this idea of convergent instrumentality out in the sort of like, I guess, nascent or kind of early AI safety literature. And it's this idea that, like, you know, if you have a goal in the world, a lot of the things you might want to do to achieve that goal could bring you into conflict with other people with other goals. And so, like, you know, if you want to cure cancer, you might want a lot of money to cure cancer. And now you're instantly in conflict with all the other people who want money. And so, you know, it's like, even though maybe very few people want money as like an end goal, it's just like the big idea is that, like, to get to a lot of goals, you need like energy and resources and wealth. And so, you know, if you end up with like any system, even if it's not conscious, but if it's like goal directed and potentially it's smarter than you, you can just stumble into conflict with it. It doesn't have to be evil or bad. It could be setting out to do something that you think is good overall, but you could get into conflict due to the methods. And the problem is, if this thing is like smarter than you, how does that conflict play out? And, you know, people start talking about like paperclip maximizers and stuff, right? You know, it's like, oh, you just told this thing to go and let's be in a factory, make me lots and lots of paperclips because we need lots of paperclips. And then like it accidentally went and consumed all the resources of the world and turned the entire world into a paperclip factory. And it's like, whoops, you know? These are old ideas. These are ideas in the AI safety, you know, debate for like a while.
I mean, there are also human concerns as well. Like what it sounds like to me that you're describing is alignment of incentives between all the actors, like the technology and the humans. And that's what we do when we organize as groups as well, like at work. Super simple example, you have to put the right incentives often for your teams in place. Otherwise, they're incentivized to do something else. If you incentivize your sales team to sell to enterprise customers, but you actually want them to, you know, sell to smaller companies, then you have to tweak the incentives. And we do have lots of experience of that, like running companies and getting that system going where all that is aligned is to some degree that. So
arguably we have lots of experiences of that going badly and lots of experiences.
You're not talking about Intercom specifically, I'm sure.
I guess, again, to steel man the argument here is like, hey, look, to what extent is that because you did a really good job of like balancing the incentives versus to what extent is that due to like a balance of power? And, you know, if there's like a power imbalance, like I would say, if you just look at humans, times when there's like massive power imbalances where, you know, things often go wrong, it's very hard to keep the incentives. If you're relying on incentives rather than power imbalances, it's tough. And like humans, you know, we put great care and attention to try and like have, you know, checks and balances and so on. And so it's like, again, it's back to this thing is, you know, you get into this discussion of superintelligence. If you want to take for granted that like, hey, it may be possible to build a superintelligence, suddenly it becomes very, very powerful. And therefore, are you going to rely on the incentives? Because it's always hard to rely on the incentives to kind of to keep things going.
Yeah, I guess we can't know until it reveals the nature of itself to us a little bit more. My personal feeling is when we obsess about superintelligence, we're obsessing about like it getting smarter than us. And there's some like risk, I suppose, but also ego thing for humans at the center of that, like the thing that really separates us from the animal kingdom almost. But I then think about, people often say AI a bit like alien intelligence. I actually think animals are a useful way of thinking about it because we have evolved to coexist peacefully with different types of intelligence, which are animal intelligence. Now, I have a dog, I have a cat, right? I look at them, like the cat is on one level possessing of a very specific but super high degree of like intelligence, like athletic ability, it's lithe, its reflexes are fast. If I like consider intelligence broadly, very intelligent and amazing and beautiful to watch.
I'm gonna jump here because I don't think this is a great analogy. And the reason, or at least it's not a comforting one. Yeah. I'm a pescatarian. I eat like some wild fish. I'm mostly vegetarian.
Yeah.
Like factory farming, like, you know, is not great for a lot of the animals involved in it. You know? And so like, I don't know if like, doesn't reassure me to hear that like, hey, the model here is like, we're have evolved to coexist peacefully with the animals, you know?
You don't like pets? What's wrong with pets?
Pets are good. I mean, like, you know, you start to get back to, you know, the Unabomber had a crazy guy, had a missive about, you know, humans are going to be pets in the future, you know?
Right.
Like, this is uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I think this should be uncomfortable, you know?
Well, you're flipping my argument around, so you're twisting it to me. So the point I was trying to make was the cat is one type of intelligence. I also have a dog who is a totally different type of intelligence to the cat's intelligence, right? Yeah. Like, you think you can talk to a dog and he kind of understands, like, it peers into your soul and all this, but also dumb as a bag of rocks on another level. I love him, but he is. So what I'm talking about is the different types of intelligence. Now, I guess you're making a point, which is, yeah, Emmett, you're the dog in this situation, right? If we fast forward.
Maybe, right?
But there's a happy coexistence between species there, I guess, like domestic dogs and cats. Hopefully we don't become domesticated as a species as well.
Yeah, if it turns out that there is, you know, it is possible to make something more intelligent than us, that's the thing to shoot for, right? Is this happy coexistence, right? And you end up something that's like benign in some sense and cares about like, you know, life in the universe and has values, good values, values like, I guess, similar to what we would like. But I guess the reason a lot of people are so exercised about this at the moment is because it just feels like there's a massive risk there. It's like, if you're going to build something that's more powerful, then you got to make sure those values are right. Like in the past, we've always relied on the balance of power. Now we've got to rely on the aligned values. And again, I think if you look at OpenAI and Anthropic and all the other players, they spend all this time talking about alignment for this reason, which is that like implicit in that is the idea that like you're going to cede some degree of power. You're no longer going to be, humans are no longer going to be the most intelligent things. Intelligence is powerful, it's dangerous. We need to make sure it's aligned. And so, yeah, you get into this alignment conversation.
What do you make of how good a job is the AI community doing of actually pursuing alignment as an end state versus lip service? Because if it all goes wrong, at least we can point to our old blog post and say, well, we mentioned alignment, so don't blame us.
I think they're doing a pretty good job. A lot of people would disagree with that, right? A lot of people would be like, hey, it's totally irresponsible to just like keep training larger and larger models. You don't know what you're going to do.
Yeah.
Beyond a certain point, that probably becomes true. I don't think we're at that point yet. And I would say is, if you look at like, again, AI safety folk, like, you know, 10 years ago, there was always this thing which is like, oh, specifying an objective function is a good idea. Like you tell it to cure cancer and it says, ah, to cure cancer, step one is to kill all the humans.
Right,
that'll be no more cancer.
Yeah.
And like, obviously that's bad. But if you play with like GPT-4 or something like that, and you're like, hey, what's a good plan to, you know, cure cancer? It doesn't say kill all the humans.
Right,
it says like, it's because you're a fairly good research plan.
Yeah.
And if you suggest to it, like, what about killing all the humans? They'll be like, no, 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 that's morally repugnant. Mm. And so like that's alignment right now. That's just, you know, at the level of the text it produces. And we can get into this whole debate as like, you know, it's just producing text. It doesn't mean it's intelligent. I guess I have a position on that. I think it is intelligent. We can get into that whole debate. But like, for my money, like, hey, that's more progress on alignment than a lot of people expected, right? Which is that, you know, it's not bad. If you're interacting with the cutting edge models, it's pretty hard to push them into suggesting repugnant things.
Yeah.
And a lot of people in the past thought, well, that's what they're going to do by default.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think that's encouraging. And again, OpenAI recently have come out and said, like, hey, they're making progress on alignment. So.
Do we know what the guardrails we're putting in that are preventing that from happening? Or is that an emergent property of the system in itself? Like, hey, there's enough non-morally repugnant content on the internet that it just behaves that way. Is it a function of training, of the source data, of something else?
Probably, like, that's a hard question. I think probably the answer people would give is that it's not just to do with the source data. Like, it's like, you know, I guess the big breakthrough or advance in the last few years is this sort of like instruct GPT thing, which is like, hey, you train your model on all the data on the internet, and then you come up with something that's like, it's not aligned. It doesn't really follow instructions properly. And then where you go is, you go and you put that through like a fine tuning or an alignment or an instruction tuning phase or whatever you want to call it, where like you give it lots of examples of like good behavior and bad behavior. And then you like adjust the model weights.
And this is the human reinforcement learning.
Yeah, yeah. The one mechanism to do that is like reinforcement learning with human feedback. Like, and so, you know, that's the paradigm. And there's a bunch of similar paradigms like that. But the basic idea is you can train on lots and lots of stuff and then sort of instruction tune it afterwards. That seems to be working like pretty well. But I guess.
But you didn't actually answer my question, which was, do we know which part of that process is making it work well? Or are we still like, I don't know, I turned some dials over here and like the thing seems to behave better for some reason.
So, I mean, again, it's like, if you don't do the instruction tuning, it will be much less aligned.
Yeah.
But exactly what's happening, like all of these models, like deep down underneath the hood, you're doing like gradient descent, right? You're sort of like, you're like, hey model, this is what good looks like. And each time you produce something that is closer to good, you kind of like get encouraged to do that more. Mm-hmm. And each time you produce something that's closer to bad, you get encouraged to do that less. All your weights are like slightly adjusted in the direction of good. Mm-hmm. And like, I guess the criticism, right, or like the people that worry a lot about alignment to be like, hey, actually, you've no idea what the hell is actually going on underneath the hood here. And like, there's ways this could go wrong. You could end up like training something to be really good at appearing aligned.
Yeah.
And then underneath, there may be some other layer of abstraction underneath it, which isn't aligned at all. And like, that's sort of like the big risk that people would call out with that sort of like behavioral alignment process. And then other people will be like, well, you know, we're still doing gradient descent. It doesn't get to decide anything. It's going to be aligned. But I kind of think there's a bit of a leap there. Like, I have a lot of time for the people who say, like, hey, this still feels there's risk you haven't pushed out there. Because it's not a system that you, like, mathematically proved was going to do X, Y, and Z, and then you built from a position of strength to strength to strength. It's a black box system you sort of tuned and you trained.
So if I was to attempt to be uncharitable to that position, here's what I would say, that it's a little bit like stockpiling nuclear weapons and saying, but, like, we've made it really careful that we're not going to push the button that makes it go off by accident. But, like, on a long enough timeline and with how accessible the technology is, we can't keep a lid on that, surely. So we can have lots of companies and individuals acting responsibly, but it's going to do nothing to protect us from, like, the worst application. Like, what you're saying sounds plausible and true to me, which is no, you can do enough to keep a lid on it, but only if you really try hard to and want to. And that's not going to be the case all the time.
You mean, like, in future, some bad actor will...
Well, let's talk about it. Like, what are the scenarios in which things go wrong? I mean, one of the, like, moral arguments for working directly on this, despite the dangers maybe associated with, is someone else, a totalitarian government or a secretive whatever somewhere, organization somewhere, is probably currently doing, like, the bad version of this right now. And we need to be able to be in that arms race almost.
At some point, that'll surely happen. Like, there's clearly, like, you know, basins of attraction in the technology landscape where, like, when you get beyond a certain point, like, if it becomes... I don't think we're at this point yet. I don't think we're at the point where we're like, oh yeah, you can definitely build a superintelligence. But if we ever get to that point where it becomes obvious to people that you can build it, people are going to do it. Like, governments and militaries and stuff are going to do it. They always do, because it's potentially useful in all sorts of military applications, right? Yeah. So, like, I think, yeah, that's going to happen. And so, again, I think the discourse here goes to, like, things like nuclear weapons and the International Atomic Energy Agency, or whatever they're called, you know, where it's like there is some form of regulation. And we're probably going to, like, if this is how it plays out, if we don't get a shock, if it isn't like, oh, hey, it turns out that intelligence just peters out with the current type of training, right? That could happen. But if that doesn't happen, yeah, people talk about it as, like, tracking graphics cards and GPUs and stuff. Mm. But, I mean, that has problems too, because presumably that'll only last for some finite period of time.
Right.
Before even that becomes, you know, easier and easier
to
do.
You can find the instructions to build your own GPU online out of...
Presumably,
tape and, yeah.
So, like... I don't know how that plays out long term,
Let's go back to the intelligence thing, because I definitely wanted to get into this with you. I know you have kind of a hot take here. So we've got a lot of kind of, like, AI, I don't know what the charitable term is, skeptics or fear mongers, depending on what type. And then you have, like, people from all across the divide, Noam Chomsky, a well-known linguist, Ted Chiang, one of my favorite sci-fi authors, wrote this article about the blurry JPEG of the web, basically saying... This is not intelligence. It's a stochastic parrot. It just is a really good parlor trick that makes it seem really smart in the way that we appreciate smarts.
Now I cut it to the mast here.
Go for it. I want to hear the Fergal's take.
I have, like, medium to high confidence that the blurry JPEG of the web take is wrong. Right. I'm probably even pulling my punch a bit there. I really have high confidence that's wrong. Like, that's this argument that, like, hey, all it's doing is really compressing down the web, and then it, like, it's like lossy compression, and you're getting some, like, compressed version of it. And, you know, the only reason why I'm not like, that's completely flat out wrong, is because, like, actually compressing down something can, you know, cause intelligence, right? Like, the ability to compress things can be a measure of intelligence, because it's like, just by compressing and predicting the next token, you're sort of, like, predicting what's going to happen next in the world and so on. So that's the out by which I'm like, if it's right, it's sort of right in the way it doesn't mean. But yeah, you know, I think if you use, and I think it's true for, like, Text DaVinci 3, the GPT 3.5 model, I think it's even more obviously true for GPT-4. If you use GPT-4, like, it gives you intelligence seeming output that, like, seems to demonstrate reasoning out of sample. So, like, you can go and you can push it to, like, consider something new that's not going to be in its training data. It's not going to be in any sci-fi story anybody's read before, because it's just, you know, choose something so outlandish. It's just so deeply improbable that this was in its training data, and then ask it questions about that scenario. And it does a pretty good job. It's not like, is it human level? It's probably doesn't do as good a job as, like, you know, some really good human that this does. But it's like, if it's not reasoning, then I don't know what reasoning means, or I struggle to tell what reasoning means.
Yeah, and you have a blog post. Maybe we can link it in show notes or something, but you have a blog post where you kind of illustrate specific examples.
I wrote at the weekend because I got frustrated because, like, you know, it's hard to be sure, right? But so many people, including experts in AI, are like, totally dismissing it. They're like, oh, this thing doesn't understand anything. It's just doing next token prediction. Like, that was always the right take in AI for like decades. But now I think the water is muddy and everyone should acknowledge the water is muddy rather than be like, no, it definitely doesn't understand anything, you know?
Although we're having this speculative conversation and throwing ourselves into the mix, it does seem like a particularly bad time to make grand predictions about the limitations of this stuff anyway. Yeah, I mean, it kind of seems like, I think that blurry JPEG of the web article was like March or something like that, I want to say. I read it. Like, and I kind of wonder if it's been disproven already by GPT-4 and some of the like apparent reasoning that we're seeing with it.
I think so. And, you know, there's lots of different positions here that are critical of it, right? There's the, you know, blurry JPEG of the web thing, which I thought was like, got really disproven very fast. Like, for my money, that's disproven. And it's hard to prove this, right? But all you can do is construct lots and lots of evidence because, you know, there's this idea of philosophical zombies or like solipsism or whatever. I don't know that you're a thinking person, right? For all I know, inside your head is a giant lookup table.
You'd be horrified.
You know, I have a subjective sensation of consciousness myself, right? And then you can get into whether that's even real. Maybe it's an illusion. But either way, like, you know, I don't feel I'm a big lookup table. I don't know about the rest of you, right? And there's this kind of thing in philosophy for a long time. You can't actually, like, it's very difficult to prove that. You can ask somebody, like, prove you're not a lookup table. And all you end up doing is kind of testing them in this behavioral way, the same way we can test GPT-4. And again, like Alan Turing in his Turing test paper way back when, kind of like honed in on this and like honed in on the idea, look, a behavioral test is sort of the best you can do. And when you do a behavioral test on these models, they seem to do a good job at what I would call reasoning, even totally out of sample. And you can never be sure with a behavioral test because, you know, a lookup table that's big enough of like all possible things that you, you know, phone book of all possible things you could ask and all possible answers would fool you. I think all you can do is be like, with the behavioral perspective, all you can do is eventually say like, look, this thing is doing such a good job when I ask it such weird things that it almost certainly couldn't have been put in the lookup table that like I'm starting to get convinced it's reasoning. And then for me, GPT-4 is beyond that bar. So can't prove it, right? Maybe in future, someone will have a theory of intelligence and, you know, they'll be able to inspect the weights of the network and say, oh, this is where the reasoning module is. We're not there yet.
Well, it does seem like we've kind of rushed past the Turing test and the acknowledgement that I think people would have said, well, correct me if I'm wrong, I understand people would have said like before this year that the Turing test has probably been passed and so on, but like certainly definitively in the last 6 months. Would you agree with that? Or am I factually incorrect there?
Well, I don't know. I happened to quickly read the Imitation Game paper again recently. I read it years and years ago. I read it again recently. And like, actually, in the test, he talks about like an average interrogator or an average judge spending 5 minutes. And with that formulation, I'd say it's probably close to being passed.
You don't think it's, I would have assumed passed with flying colors at this stage, no?
I don't know. I expect that if you sat me down in front of GPT-4 and a human, I would be able to learn tricks to like push it into areas that it's weak at and then be able to detect signals of it there. And I could probably get good at telling it apart. I expect like most people who are going to spend time when it probably evolves strategy.
I think you have to have an eye. I mean, at this, you work with it every day and you have an eye. Like, let's say, for example, with Midjourney V5, I think.
Yeah.
We kind of got to the stage where, for the vast majority of people, the tells that are in the image are
fingers,
no longer
right?
But like, they fix the fingers, the blurring of the weird shapes in the back. And if you know what to look for, you can still spot a bit of feathering where the hair should be, you know, and large it's gone away. But I think you need to be quite forensic at this stage, at least for the imagery stuff. And I assume that the same for every other
We're kind of there at GPT-4. I would say it's at a similar thing.
Yeah, me too.
You know, casual inspection. And if you prompt it the right way, and then, you know, to a 5 minute inspection from an average person plucked off the street, I think it's probably passed. And I think, you know, when I look at Turing's original paper, that feels like it's then passed the spirit, that original formulation. Be interested
if
someone...
If you imagine a Turing test for imagery, my guess would be we've also passed that as well.
Yeah.
Probably not for even voice synthesis at this stage, and certainly not things like music, I would say. Movies are definitely not there, but I think we're in that very early, like... The thing is made up of the tells rather than like seeming like it's almost normal on video, generative video. Yeah. So it's just interesting to see this stuff like progresses at different speeds, maybe just because of the training models, or do you think different media has fundamental limitations?
I'd say probably due to the training models. I don't feel that there's a fundamental reason why it won't be able to do really good video synthesis in time.
Although the barrier to fooling a human is probably much higher with something like video, just how attuned we are biologically to movement, things like that. It's a lot easier to spot a fake.
Neural hardware supposed to pick out lions in the bush coming towards
us. Of years worth psychology intended to get us to run when we're supposed
to run.
Whereas,
like, you know, reading text and stuff is much lower bandwidth for us as a result, you know.
Let's talk maybe more practical terms, bring it back to like applying this to the technology world and products and so on. People often talk about the S curve of a technology, right? Like at the start, there's a slow, but then rapid often takeoff or maturation of the technology. And then it tapers out. So phones were amazingly awesome year on year improvements for a few years. And now this year's phone is kind of the same as last year's because the S curve has tapered off. Where in the S curve are we with this technology? Or like, probably impossible question to ask, how would you even start? What do you look for to have a sense of where we're at on that?
Yeah, a sense in which I think it's impossible to know for sure. And I think we have to be okay with that. I would say that like things I think that we know that there's going to be a ton of money and a ton of resources that are going to flow into this space. Mm-hmm. Like suddenly large language models, like whether they're on the path to super intelligence or not, whether that's even achievable or not, I think we don't know for sure. But we do know that they're extremely industrially useful in their current form. And there's likely like many more generations of model that will be like industrially useful without sort of like, you know, touching on dangerous stuff, right? Yeah. And people should go and they should build that and we should go and turn those into products and they should be, you know, make humans more efficient and remove drudgery and help us get a lot more done. And I think we're seeing that. I think that's great. So where are we on that? Well, you know, it feels quite likely that people are going to train more models that are like bigger and better than GPT-4 because, you know, so much money is going to flow into this space, so many graphics cards. It feels quite likely that people are going to get better at making smaller and more efficient models that do really impressive things. And that's, so, you know, it's going to be way easier to productize and to build cool products on all this sort of tech. I think like that feels like I've extremely high confidence that's coming over the next few years. Beyond that, whether we, you know, do we hit diminishing returns, right? That's possible, right? But I would say that like, you know, the S curve, the output we get is this sort of like complicated function of a whole bunch of different stuff. Like GPUs, we're going to end up making a lot more GPUs. NVIDIA is going to make a lot more, right? And then it's going to get better at it. They're going to get cheaper as they scale it out, as they put more design time into it. And then also like, there's going to be like tons of research students figuring out better algorithms to train large neural networks. That's going to get better. Industrial applications, people are going to figure out caching and like building smaller versions of the models. People are going to use the big, powerful models to train smaller, lighter, faster ones. So there's all these like complex overlapping feedback loops. So I'd be really surprised if it stopped anytime soon. I think it's going to accelerate. And then weighed against that is like some things just get harder over time. Like you want to find like more antibiotics, right? You find the easy to find ones first, and then over time it gets harder and harder to find new ones. It's possible that like, you know, we get the easy gains first here and then you hit scaling laws and so on. OpenAI have said that recently. They said like, oh, we don't think the path to more intelligence is to train bigger and bigger models. I'm skeptical of that. I bet we'll get, if not, maybe we'll hit a limit here, but I bet we'll get more intelligence with bigger models. And Google have come out recently talking about this, you know, going to train a new model. They called it Gemini at their event. So they're going to train a bigger model. And so I think everyone's going to do that. And we're going to find that.
On top of all the variables that you just described, the thing that strikes me that's kind of different this time around or with this technology wave is the speed and scale is totally different in terms of how quickly it's going to get integrated into our products and our lives. Bill Gates had this post recently and he was like, hey, look, I saw ChatGPT or whatever he was looking at, something from OpenAI. And he was like, the biggest deal in technology since the microprocessor when I first saw it in the 70s.
Yeah.
And it makes you think, shit, like when he saw that microprocessor and he was like, bing, it was him and 100 guys at the Homebrew Computer Club in some meetup or something. And they got access to it and played with it and gradually rolled it out. One of the things I thought that was dizzying this time around with the AI stuff was, and again, my mind mostly goes back to, I guess it was March, and it would have been when OpenAI started releasing APIs and people started to really like hack on top of it. Instead, you have this explosion of creativity, which was amazing, but millions of people get to hack on this immediately. And I think that is just going to be a very different dynamic. Like the amount of creativity that can immediately be applied to the raw technology is orders of magnitude bigger than we've ever had before when we've had this new kind of enabling technology show up. And it's just going to add to the complete lack of predictability.
I mean, again, I think this is a huge technology revolution. I said this back on my first podcast with Des after ChatGPT came out. I think it's just going to be huge. It's going to be, I think, bigger than the internet. Maybe it's going to be as big as the Industrial Revolution if it goes far enough. But it's also, it's like, this is the first one of this magnitude that we've had in a while. And like now we've built out this massive software stack for our society. Like everyone has a mobile phone, mm-hmm. that's a general purpose computer. Mm-hmm. You know, when the internet came, you know, you had this long, slow deployment. You had to run fiber around the world. Mm-hmm. You had to like run, you had to figure out how do you get this the last mile to everybody. Now
the infrastructure for delivery is there.
The infrastructure like for delivery everybody is in the there.
World. Yeah.
So what needs to happen at scale? Like GPUs.
Yeah.
You need to probably build a lot of GPUs in the world to be able to like run inference at scale. You know, and then we need to build products, and the products need to be adaptive. It's like we spend a lot of time trying to figure out, okay, what's the least powerful, fastest model that we can use for this particular part of the product or that particular part of the product. All that needs to happen. But the product development loop here can be pretty fast, and the rest of it seems to be bottlenecked on, you know, scaling GPUs and unit economics. And I think the unit economics are going to get really good, really fast. Even GPT 3.5 Turbo is not expensive, you know?
Does the software get fast and cheap fast enough for there to be no bottleneck around GPUs?
Not at the moment. I think, you know, GPT-4 is a very expensive model and absolutely bottlenecked on GPUs at the moment. But like, you know, surely that will change, or someone will produce, like, you know, I don't know, I've no private information here, but I suspect that GPT 3.5 Turbo is like a distilled version of like Text DaVinci 3 or something like that, an instructed distilled version, because it's cheaper to run. I bet it's cheaper on the back end. I bet it's because they have a smaller model. Who knows? Maybe they'll produce like a distilled down version of GPT-4 at some point that is 10 times faster. That could happen anytime for all I know.
Mm. For the time being, though, the cost aspect is also a new kind of thing for product people, at least, to consider. I mean, you know, hey, here's our relational database. Hit that database. Obviously, like latency reasons, you want to be efficient or whatever. But yeah, like here, there's some fundamental limitations based on the costs of actually providing this tech that I think a lot of businesses are also looking at it and going like, what's our model? What's our customer acquisition cost? Or how do we monetize usage of our product? Because there is probably a set of products out there where the use cases are ideally suited, but the business model around the product is not either.
Totally.
So I just think there's a lot of interesting product challenges there, and maybe even some new companies that need to happen where, you know, you can't retrofit.
Totally. And, you know, this was the case in the past. Like once upon a time, Hotmail gave you a certain limit to the amount of megabytes of email storage you would have. And Gmail came along and it was effectively unlimited because storage got cheap in the interim. So, you know, there's been lots of products in the past where they've been bottlenecked on hardware costs. And then that bottleneck has went away and has disappeared. And so, you know, I expect we're going to see something here. Like we're such early days here and, you know, big, powerful models. But again, like a lot of the time, like they're cheap compared to a human doing the same type of intelligence task, like really cheap. And so, you know, it's like, it's just like, is it valuable enough? Is it something you wouldn't have a human do? Is it valuable enough to have a machine do it all the time? For a lot of stuff, the answer to that is yes, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think we're going to see, again, really fast adoption here, and models are going to get cheaper, and yeah, things are going to feed back. Yeah.
One of the things you said there actually reminded me of something you talked about, Gmail and the email limit. And famously, it was like considered a, it was launched on April Fool's Day. And was it an April Fool's joke that they were actually giving you a gigabyte of storage? But internally at Google, people talked about those kind of big computer science breakthroughs, like going from 10 megabytes to a gigabyte of storage, or not having to like do a round trip reload to the server to get new data for the page or whatever, and use Ajax instead.
Yeah.
So all of these new technical capabilities unlocked new like interface possibilities.
Yes.
So in the case of Gmail, now that you have a gigabyte, you don't have to archive or folderize. You can just search, and you know, everything can go in threads. And so it changes the nature of the product that's possible with this.
Yeah.
AI is going to open up a whole bunch of new products. So we're going to probably in the early days see a bunch of products like retrofitting themselves. And we ourselves did this as well. What's the easiest opportunity? Well, we've got this often used text box in our product.
Yeah.
Let's add the ability to like summarize, rephrase, shorten, blah, blah, blah. And we added that, and our customers loved it because there's a great use case when you're talking to your customers to be able to do that. And probably every text box on the internet that needs one will have one of those soon.
Or the operating system will do it.
Well, but that's what I'm getting at. Like, what are the next level things? And from an interface point of view, I think there's lots of interesting questions here about, well, what will be possible? Or you're talking about a lot of money flooding in.
Yeah.
That's basically going to enable new types of products. I think it's just interesting to think, are we going towards a very much more conversational, either, you know, verbally conversational or typed conversational? We've been talking about conversational commerce, and we in Intercom have spent a lot of time thinking about bots. So aside from the raw technical capabilities, I think it'll open up a whole offshoot of the evolution of software, because you can build very different type of software with this now.
I think we're going to do it. I think that change could come quite fast. So as a thought experiment here, I'm like, you know, I always rely on this thing, which is like, if you had like, you know, an intelligent human that you work with a lot, who like, who knows you and knows your preferences, and you were like interfacing with them, they were like driving the computer, and you were just like telling them what to do.
Mm.
Like, what would that look like, right? A lot of the commands you would give would be verbal. Mm. Sometimes you might reach down and say, oh, let me just take over the mouse from you. But a lot of what you'd give would be kind of like high level and verbal. But then you'd often like look at the screen to like sort of see the output. If someone has a bar chart with like a bunch of data, you don't want to describe that verbally. You want to see that visually. And so I think that like, you know, I think we're going to end up in future where a lot of the input to the computer is verbal. It won't always be, but I think a lot of it will be verbal.
Yeah.
Probably when you're working in Figma, you're probably still going to drive something that looks like a mouse. But a lot of input's going to be verbal. But then a lot of the output is going to be like customized on the fly. Probably text, because it's really fast. But I personally feel like user interfaces are pretty likely to like go away. Like, as in, designers won't design user interfaces. AI agents will design user interfaces on the fly. So if the agent feels you need to see a bar chart to make sense of the data it's telling you, it'll render a bar chart. And otherwise it won't. Otherwise it'll like render stuff in a very ad hoc way. And it'll probably take into account, you know, some best practices will emerge for AI agents, and you'll have preferences. You'll basically get an interface customized to the task you want and what you're familiar with, rather than something designed by hand by
AI. That's very plausible. I think with any new thing, we imagine that it will be like, wow, everything will become text first now. And in fact, it means no, you'll have everything you have today plus a whole other set of things that are now text first as well. So I think it'll be largely additive rather than like upending things.
I don't agree. I think there's going to be an upending moment here. Now, I think we're going to evolve there. I think the way we're going to evolve there is every complex piece of software is going to have like some sort of freeform texting where you describe your task and you play it. But I do think it'll change. I think like you will probably end up with an agent that navigates the software for you. And I think that's going to be better than navigating the software for like 99% of use cases.
So that's super different to the LLMs we're used to working with today in an important way, because today you talk to them and they give you text back and that's it. But you're describing a world maybe we're just starting to creep into with ChatGPT plugins, where they're starting to act on your behalf.
I think it's even wrong to say that like today you put text into them and they give you text back. Like the really scrappy early interface to ChatGPT and GPT-4 and stuff looks like that due to an accident of history, right?
Right.
And low down on a technological level, they do in fact do text completion. But I think that's going to disappear pretty fast. And if you look at like Finn, right? That's not how we use Finn. In Finn, like the LLM is like a building block deep down. You talk to a bot. Sometimes you click buttons to get it to do stuff. And you're going to see that again and again. The LLMs are like initially the fastest way to integrate them is like text input, text output. But they're just going to become a building block. And then people are going to use it. And, you know, I think ultimately medium term, LLM is like an intelligent building block that people learn to use to get your software to do intelligent things. Long term, you're probably going to end up with like an intelligent agent that your browser is probably going to turn into an intelligent agent. Like your browser's got a user agent string. And once upon a time, people were like, yeah, it's an agent, you know.
And the agent is clicking on coordinates on the screen for you.
Probably initially for like backwards compatibility.
Yeah.
But then I think like why would you just build APIs? Why would you build websites?
I mean, that's what I think as well, or that's what the logical part of my brain thinks. Yeah. But then I think most of the software that we build today is built using HTML, which was not like designed for it. Also an accident of history that we're building like software applications using a markup language with loads of other stuff sprinkled on top. And so maybe we'll just end up building what we have kind of thing, you know.
I'm sure it'll be there as like some compatibility layer, some intermediate
or a
layer.
Fallback or something like that.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And what we're actually talking about there, Fergal, to be clear, is like, it's looking at a picture of what's on your screen and it's finding the text that says click here and it's simulating moving your mouse to actually click on the click here for you. Is that what you're actually talking about when you mean an agent who's acting in the browser?
No, I kind of don't. Like, and again, this is speculative, but like, so I could imagine that like there's a legacy government website that you want to get something done on, right? You need to like update your bank account details. And what you do is you just say to your agent on your phone or your desktop or whatever, maybe it's your web browser, maybe it's made by a company like Google, who knows? And you just kind of say to it, it's like, hey, I need to update my bank account on the like government social security website. And like your agent goes, okay, yeah, that's done. Right. And like what happened in the background was your, you know, little intelligent agent went and like drove the website and stuff. It didn't show that to you. It didn't render that to you.
Right. And, but it's task completed. And you can see this with the ChatGPT thing where they're like, I'm searching the web now. Okay, I found the result now. And
So, you know, after a certain point, people working in the government are going to be like, well, why do we need to keep building the websites? Like, we just need to build the API.
Right. I mean, LLMs are a pretty awesome API to an API in a sense, right? And you can layer it on top and it's just a more human readable API to any machine readable API.
Yeah, exactly. But I'd phrase it differently. I'd be like, hey, the intelligence that we happen to have comes in the form of LLMs at the moment. That's going to get abstracted away. We won't really care what it's like down underneath the hood. We just know that it's something that you can just like ask it for what you want and it'll go complete the task. And if you say to it, you say like, hey, like what was the unemployment rate in Ireland over the last like 10 years for people in their 20s? It'll go to like the Central Statistics Office website. It'll download the data. It'll like parse it. It'll render a graph and so on. Like, and to give let me make this concrete, right? I have a talk coming up and I needed a graph for that. I needed a graph of like, hey, what's the difference between interpolation and extrapolation? And I went to Google and I spent time in Google, like trying to go and like find the exact graph I wanted. I kind of had it in my head. I was writing my search query in Google. And after like 2 minutes or something, I thought, I just can't find the right graph. So I went to GPT and I said, GPT-4, in Python, generate me the following graph. And it did. And it generated me the Python code. And I just put it into my notebook. And I have my graph, I copy pasted my graph and I put it in my presentation. Like the fastest way for me to get the graph I wanted was to have an intelligent system generate the code to generate the graph. That was faster than trying to find it on Google. And like, there's a lot of interface friction. That's going to go away. And it's going to end up with a really fast agent that accomplishes tasks. Once you have that, I think that's going to totally eat your current software stack.
Replace the current software because it's better. I guess the thing that I'm understanding what you're saying a little bit better, but I guess what I'm imagining is I don't see all software being reduced to a text input box because that's the wrong input and output modality for a lot of stuff, including what you just described. So a good example is all the image generation stuff, which is loads of fun to play with, right? But you got to go onto a Discord bot to engage with Midjourney and so on. And then you have to like, hack it by writing, you know, f stop 1.4 hyper realistic. And I'm like, no, this is a visual, fundamentally a visual thing that I'm trying to create. I want a more tactile UI. I want more knobs and dials, like make it brighter, make it, you know, what are the properties of it that I can dial up and down and play with, rather than feeling my way blind in effectively a command line interface, because the lack of affordances in a command line interface means it's often not the best UI.
But I think the future there would probably be something like, you say to like your agents, you're like, hey, I want to edit those photos I took yesterday, right? And what it does then, right, is it sort of knows you. It knows your level of sophistication. Like when you say you want to edit the photos, well, actually, I don't want to make assumptions about you. For all I know, you're a pro photographer.
I'm a lazy man, if that helps. So, sitting down and editing photos, yeah, so
it knows whether you're like, it knows that when you want to edit your photos, that you're looking for like four filters and a crop tool. Or alternatively, it knows that like you want to like do super prosumer stuff, right? And accordingly, it basically goes and it looks in its pattern library, right, for like the best interfaces for each, right, of those, and it renders that interface for you.
Dynamically. And dynamically. Then you're saying, actually, I want a more professional, I want more, and it goes, okay, I'll give you the pro version of the UI, and it dynamically renders that for me.
And so there'll be some tasks that you do on like an ad hoc basis, a once-off basis. You don't want to learn to use the interface and so on. It's Des was talking about this recently in a different podcast. It's work day, and you need to like, you know, update your vacation time and work day. And it's like, oh my God, I don't know what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't want to learn an interface to that. I just want the task complete. Then there'll be other things where it's like, oh, it's, I am a professional programmer and I need to learn to use the IDE. Yeah. And like some designer has taught in great detail, you know, what I am going to want to do and need to do. And it's probably some light layer of customization there, but there's still like a well-designed interface that I am going to learn to use. And I think that like interfaces for the former, for like tasks I want to do, a lot of them are going to disappear, or a lot of them are going to be like rendered on an ad hoc basis.
Mm.
And then for like the latter, yeah, they'll be adaptive.
I agree with all of what you said. It also occurs to me like additional nuance. It'll entirely depend. Like one of the big on the task you're doing, right? Right. So you're not going to want to go like you're a pilot and you're like, time to land the plane. Hey, LLM, auto assemble an interface for me to do it, right? So there's going to be regulation and things like that, I'm sure,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
But that does reflect, I think, one of the big differences, which is like going from working with computers, which were like, we've always thought of them as this highly deterministic, binary, on-off switch driven truth machines, you know? And now suddenly the nature of that is shifting a lot. And I think that's a big change as well, like, you know, as users and all the stuff that we're describing, both what you can expect, how you can expect it to work for you personally, and the amount of fungibility or control you have over it, all the way to the other end of the spectrum. So I think we will definitely start to see lots more exciting, fizzy experimentation, divergence, and the level of customization we have today. You can change your wallpaper or whatever, like the font size will probably pale in comparison.
Sure.
Yeah. You also said something interesting I wanted to come back to, which was like, hey, imagine designers who are mostly like, you know, assembling from a library. The task of user interface design, I think, is an interesting one as well, because we've kind of been setting ourselves up for that with design systems. A design system is like a pattern library of components. If you're building a big product, you want it to be consistent. You want to be able to put it together fast. So a lot of the groundwork we've been laying and the systems we've been building, even on like, let's say, design teams and probably engineering teams as well, building components that can quickly be reused by these systems, is all pointed towards like a fairly fast, our ability to build these tools fairly quickly. I mean, what you were describing there is something that takes your design system and builds a UI from it. And it doesn't seem miles away.
Or maybe it takes the standard open source design system and builds a tool from it. Like, I don't know if this will happen at the level of like individual companies, or if it'll just happen at the level of like a broad horizontal level, like a brand.
Yeah,
you know?
That would be so boring. It would be tragic, I think. You know, I think back to iOS 7. Before that, we had skeuomorphism and everything. And then they went super opinionated flat design.
Yeah.
And the entire industry was so influenced by Apple's dominance that like all the websites started to look the same. You know, Apple released their human interface guidelines and they say, look, iPhone apps should look like this now.
Maybe.
But it led to a, if you'll pardon the pun, a flattening of of diversity and a more boring web visually, in my opinion. Yeah, but that was in service of like these systems that can kind of build themselves.
You'd be able to tell your agents that you want it to look like funky and retro 70. And it actually want some, understand that.
Some bound Corinthian leather for this UI. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and like, you got to imagine that'll come. Like, I think things will get like way more customizable in terms of what people actually use, because you know, you have an intelligent layer that like understands how to construct an interface with a given team. You probably do that today. If you set off today to build like Mid Journey for user interfaces, you could probably do it, right?
Yeah.
Like it's working at the level of like image synthesis, like pixels. But I bet it's possible to like somehow, like, you know, we've got like GPT-4 that can generate like code to write user interfaces, or can generate, you know, CSS of user interfaces. And then we've got like, you know, the image synthesis models where like you embed all the images and you embed the text and you sort of squish them together. Like, I bet you could build something pretty fast that will.
It's so funny because you're saying this, right? And my emotional reaction is like, no, but you don't get it. What it doesn't understand is you have to think about usability and understanding humans and all this kind of stuff. And then I'm like, yeah, there are all those reasoning capabilities that we talked about. It seems like it has now. And so... As we're talking about it, I'm having that emotional like
crisis.
The AI is coming for your discipline or whatever. But I also, I mean, I'm honestly not that worried about it, because I think a lot of designers, and I've heard this said for programmers as well, are not going to mourn like the grunt work that this largely like makes faster and improves. And it actually allows them to maybe go up a Zoom level and think a little bit more like about the solution rather than the execution of the solution or the treatment. And honestly, like building products, you know, is still bloody super laborious and super time consuming.
Yeah.
And so I think it'll be great to see what happens if we take some of the grunt work out of that and some of the death march stuff, maybe, that sometimes a project that can really slog on can kind of feel like. So it's an opportunity for sure to like pop up a Zoom level.
Does this whole debate again and again around like jobs and job displacements and job change, and like certainly something's going to happen here. Now, look, maybe it's like when I hear that, honestly, I'm like, oh, maybe that means you don't need designers anymore. Maybe you just need product managers, right? And like a product manager now can do everything a designer used to do, right? And, you know, maybe you don't need a programmer. Maybe you just need a product manager, right? And we all turn into like product managers in the future. And like the role of a product manager blurs. It's like it's someone who does like, you know, what currently, you know, a senior advanced designer does overlapping with a PM. So I don't know. And maybe there could be a lot more roles and jobs like that, or maybe it'll be fewer.
I think we should lean into that. I mean, one thing I notice in my career that I've noticed myself and the people around you, the more senior you become, the less specific to your discipline it actually is. And you have to become general leader. And so
I had this conversation with Fan on the design team, right? Which is this idea that like, you know, you've all these different disciplines, and you can almost think of like when you're junior in a discipline like engineering or product and design, you're like the edge of a circle. And then like, as you get more senior, you get in more and more towards the center of the circle. And like in the center of the circle is the product, right? And so like, as you get more and more senior, your world becomes more and more about the product you're building and less about the angle that you come from.
Yeah, your discipline specific.
The discipline merge as you get.
I can see that too. Yeah. So we're all going to become PMs. Is that the plan?
Yeah. I mean, like ultimately that's what we're trying to do in a job like this.
I mean, what is a PM if not a product person without any directly applicable practical skills? Am I right, Virgil?
Yeah. I know. Of course, the PM was.
There's a ton of stuff we didn't get to. We talked about other stuff as well, like the risks of this stuff, things that have been well covered elsewhere, like job losses or whatever.
Yeah.
This definitely seems like the type of thing we could come back to and have an updated version of this discussion in a few months' time. So maybe we'll see how that goes.
Yeah.
Cheers, Virgil.
Thanks, Emma.
This is Inside Intercom.